Good morning. We are on our second day of sitting for the June calendar and our last group of cases before the court recesses for the summer. And I would like to ask that the following group stand. The Partyville Elementary School, would you please stand? Well, thank you very much for coming this morning. You may be seated. The schools are here with our Court with Class program, which is a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. This program invites students to come to the court and hear cases. And in some instances, the court has been has provided the students with some materials. If you are not familiar with this case and you want to familiarize yourself with it, there is a summary of this case out on the table in the foyer, and you should go get the summary. Let me now introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. That's the bench today. And any need for further announcements, we'll call our first case, 02-0815, Crystal Lake Cheese Factory versus Lurk and Susan Catlin. Arguing for Crystal Lake Cheese Factory is Robert H. Duffy of Quarles and Brady. Mr. Duffy. Before you begin, Mr. Duffy, let me just make sure that our we all are on the same page on this. Then Monica Murphy will argue on behalf of Susan Catlin. Ms. Murphy is with the Wisconsin Coalition for Advocacy. Then Assistant Attorney General, you have 15 minutes. Assistant Attorney General David Rice will have 15 minutes arguing for Lurk, and Mr. Duffy, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Agreed? Okay. You may proceed, Mr. Duffy.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Bob Duffy, and along with Sean Scullin, I represent Crystal Lake Cheese Factory, the respondent in this case. Also present in the courtroom today are Tony Carella, Crystal Lake's president, who is seated to the far left, as well as Tom Masici, its vice president. We are very grateful for the court having taken this opportunity to decide this case. It's apparent from the number of briefs that have been filed, as well as the amicus briefs, that everyone considers this to be a very important issue before the court. Although I would like to talk about a number of points, my most important point is to answer any questions you may have. I have 4 points, the first of which I think talks about the whole case itself and the basic issue before this court. The issue in my mind is whether or not the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act requires employers to create a new job for an individual whose disability prevents that person from performing the responsibilities of an existing position. Crystal Lake's position, consistent with the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, is that the WFEA's reasonable accommodation provisions may not be construed so broadly. We base that on a number of things, including the statute itself. If you look at the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act,
I've been troubled with your statement of that issue in your briefs as well as here, because you don't define what you mean by create a new job. I have no argument that WFEA does not require an employer to create a brand new job, but that's not what was done here. Or are you saying that's what was done here? So what I want you to do is define for me what you mean by create a new job.
I think that's exactly what was done here, Justice Bablish.
Okay, is what that, do you mean? What's a creative
is that the Labor and Industry Review Commission basically decided that because Ms. Caitlin could not perform the important functions of her position as a lead person in a small wholesale department at Crystal Lake Cheese Factory, that what Crystal Lake was obligated to do was to create a position which would encompass only those responsibilities that she could perform, not the responsibilities of the job as it existed. That's why we believe that it is proper to look at this from the context of creating a position.
What does the term reasonable accommodation mean, then? When the statutes require reasonable accommodation, it seems to me that what you're saying could encompass creating a new job could mean if she can't do one of the things, like let's say she can't seal envelopes. That you seem to be saying that by sending her back to work, you would be creating a new job. I don't think that's what the statutes mean at all.
Certainly, we're not taking the position that if a person is unable to do one very minor responsibility, that an employer may not, as a part of reasonable accommodation, be required to assign that minor responsibility to someone else. But when you look in the context of this case, we're not talking about minor responsibilities. It's undisputed that on a daily basis, in this small four-person department, the lead person had to step in and perform the jobs of the other three workers, that they worked as a team, and that as a result of her accident and the fact that she was confined to a wheelchair, she wasn't able to do significant functions of her job, including the ability to move cheese in and out of the cooler, to get it off of the racks, to do what's called a cryovasing machine, to cut cheese, basically a vast majority of her responsibilities.
Who decides whether you use the term important functions? I guess another one might be significant functions or essential functions, right?
Right.
Who decides that? And is it a question of fact for a LURC, or is it a question of law as to whether the functions that cannot be done are essential or important or significant?
We believe that it's a question of law whenever the court is required to take a look at the statute and determine what constitutes reasonable accommodation and whether or not certain functions are essential or important or the functions as the statute requires.
So if I understand your position is that if the employee cannot do every single function of the work, which was done before the disability, that does not necessarily relieve the employer of keeping the employee.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't want to interrupt.
So that's under 2A, right?
Right.
But that you have the employer must make reasonable accommodations, which might mean job changes.
Well, if you look at the history of the statute.
Does it mean some job changes?
It may or may not, depending upon the circumstances.
So this is very fact-specific.
It's fact-specific, but it's ultimately a legal question.
Would reasonable accommodations be related to the change of bathroom, the change of location of shelving, things of that nature? That's what I think of reasonable. Now, the Court of Appeals said, well, in this department, the way it was operated, that some of the other employees could do those jobs. And does that bother you, that some of the other employees could do the jobs?
No, it doesn't bother me, Justice Wilcox. In fact, that is exactly the fact, and that's part of the reason why there was such a problem in this case for Crystal Lake. Because it was a small department, only four people, all of the employees had to be able to perform all of the jobs. There was testimony about the fact that on a daily basis, each employee transferred from one place to another, one position to another. They had to do that because people would be gone for telephone calls, because they would get behind on the wrapping versus the cutting versus the pulling, and they all had to chip in order to do that. And if they didn't do that, there was a problem with the production that would get out that day. There was a problem with whether or not they could meet the various exigencies that happen in a factory.
Let me just follow up. I've got another. This question may or may not be too relevant. You can tell me. But let's say that this wasn't Ms. Catlin. Let's say this was Ms. A or Mr. B, who came off the street with the same, quote, disabilities. Would the company be required to make reasonable accommodations? In other words, this was a former employee, but wouldn't it be the same if anybody with a disability wanted to get that job?
I don't think it changes whether it's an applicant or whether it's an existing employee. An employer would have a duty to reasonably accommodate it, provided that reasonable accommodation would allow the individual to perform the functions of the position.
And the function of the position seems to be able to lift 40-pound cheese blocks, to place them or to take them off of shelving, to put them in the wrapping process, etc. That you said that this person, Ms. Catlin, would not be able to perform.
That's correct. That's precisely
it. So basically, you're saying it would be the same whether it was Ms. Catlin or someone else in with that capacity.
That is correct. And I think in this case, when the court looks at reasonable accommodation and what does it mean, there are two problems as to why, in this case, Crystal Lake couldn't do it reasonably. The first is because when you look at accommodation in a bigger context, accommodation is to allow an individual with the accommodation to do the important functions. There was no accommodation that anyone could provide Ms. Catlin that would allow her to do the important functions of this position. None.
What position?
Position of lead person in the warehouse department.
She testified that she hardly did those jobs of cheese cutter or Cairo vacuum, if I'm pronouncing that right, when she was fit. She just filled in for those two others when they weren't around, but her testimony was she hardly did them.
Justice Bablich, at one point that was her testimony, but there are two problems with it. It's inconsistent with her own testimony in other places. It's also inconsistent with every other witness who testified in this case.
But the finder of fact here, Lurk, agreed with her, right?
But that's part of the problem, Justice Bablich, is Lurk reversed the finder of fact, which was the administrative law judge Olstad, on credibility decisions, including what were the important functions that she had to regularly do, without ever consulting with the administrative law judge as to the credibility decisions that he made.
Mr. Duffy, I'm particularly concerned about paragraph 14 of the Commission's finding of facts. That's the one that says, as of the date she sought reinstatement, the complainant was physically able to perform most of the jobs in the wholesale department, including, and then bing, 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 bing. Now, given this finding of fact, how does the court react to that?
Well, two things. One is it's contrary to what Judge Olstad found, which was that she could not perform the duties that she was regularly required to perform. And again, Lurk reversed without ever consulting with Judge Olstad, who made credibility decisions on this important issue. Second, it's contrary to Ms. Catlin's own testimony, in which she repeatedly stated that the duties never changed. Everybody jumped in where needed. That means that if someone was done on cutting, I'd have to go help out. That means if the labor gets behind, I have to go help out. That means if the cryovaser gets behind, I have to go help out. It's inconsistent with the testimony that was offered
at the
hearing.
But the findings of fact of the trial of the hearing examiner said, for instance, paragraph 11, Catlin was able to perform some but not all of the duties. For example, she could not retrieve blocks of cheese from the upper shelves in the cooler because she could not climb a ladder. That's not what you just got finished saying. Where in the record do you support what you just said, what the hearing examiner found?
I don't think it's inconsistent, Your Honor. We're not contending that Ms. Catlin couldn't perform some of the responsibilities. What our position is that Ms. Catlin couldn't perform many of the important responsibilities which she had to do on a daily basis. And I've just cited her own testimony in that regard, and our brief cites to the record as well on that. Every witness who testified to the fact that the lead person in this small four-person department had to be able to fill in on each job on a daily basis. That was a critical function of that position.
Does this wholesale department still exist?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
How does that enter into all of this?
Well, I think it goes ultimately to the back pay issue. If this court were ultimately to find that Crystal Lake behaved in a way that was inconsistent with the statute, it goes to how long the back pay would go, because there's evidence in the record that the wholesale department was closed down even by the time of the hearing, which happened in the year 2000.
So what's the remedy here, just back pay?
Again, that ultimately is going to be a matter which I suppose will get back before the commission if the parties can't agree, but there is a question as to whether there is back pay that will be required, and if so, how long.
But what about getting a job?
Well, the Labor and Industry Review Commission ordered reinstatement to the extent that there was a position that was available. The wholesale department closed down. There was no position available, but it's Crystal Lake's position that there was never a position available.
Okay.
You take the position that you want this case sent back for further findings, and that this court should follow, and I think this is also in one of the amicus briefs, the ADA, as far as the factors for determining hardship. Now, there's a difference. Wisconsin WFEA uses hardship. The federal is undue hardship. But I think basically we're talking about the same thing. In what would you want this to go back for?
Well, as a first matter, we don't think it should go back. We think that the Supreme Court should be able to say that based upon the purpose behind the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, the fact that it requires individuals to be employed if they are properly qualified, the fact that it only says people are properly qualified if they can perform the functions of the job, that we think the Supreme Court should be able to say as a matter of law that requiring an employer to create a new job, to hire someone, to force someone else to do important functions is not reasonable under the WFEA. But assuming that the court doesn't get there, we think it is important to send it back on the issue of hardship. There was testimony by Mr. Robertson, who was Crystal Lake's operations manager, about the problems that were created here because of what would have happened if they had to bring Ms. Caitlin back under these circumstances, including the fact that they would have to hire someone else to do her to do part of her job, the fact that it would result in a slowdown in production.
Isn't the McMullen case different from the principle of law that you articulated?
I don't think McMullen is different at all, Justice Prosser. If you look at McMullen, here's a case where the Court of Appeals said that the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act may require an employer to transfer an employee to a position that the employee can perform. That case was limited to a situation where the employer had an available position that the person could perform all of the functions for, and the employer refused to transfer the person to that job. That's not the case here. There was no job at Crystal Lake that she could do. And as a result, her own expert, and then ultimately Lurk, decided that what would happen is Crystal Lake should have to create a job for her, because none existed.
Is it consistent with Target stores?
Target is an interesting case. Again, it's not really on all fours as it relates to the facts here, because Target relates to a temporary forbearance or clemency of a work rule. But what's important about Target is look what the court said in Target about the relationship between reasonable accommodation under 111.34 sub 1 sub b, the statute that says you have to reasonably accommodate unless there's hardship, and what it said about the relationship between that statute and the 111.34 sub 2 sub a, that says an employer does not have to accommodate in a situation where an employee is unable to adequately perform the functions of the position. And what the court said in Target was that when read together, the only reasonable construction of these two provisions is that the purpose of reasonable accommodation is to enable employees to adequately undertake job-related responsibilities. Again, there was no reasonable accommodation here that would allow Ms. Caitlin to perform the important functions of her position.
Okay, so that's what I'm driving at. I want to know what your reading of these two statutes are. Now, on page 17 of Mr. Rice's brief, he reads it as follows, that the complainant must show he is an individual with a disability within the meaning, and the employer took one of the employment actions, termination. But those are not disputed here, right? There is a disability and there was a termination.
No dispute about that.
Okay. Then it goes on to say, the employer, citing Target, the employer then has the burden of proving under 111.34.2a that it's not a violation of the Act to take the employment action on the basis of the disability because the disability is reasonably related to the individual's ability to adequately undertake the job-related responsibilities of that individual's employment. You agree with that?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And you have an so that's one burden. Additionally, you have the burden of proving under 1B that it did not, you did not refuse to reasonably accommodate the disability in a manner that would enable the individual to adequately undertake his or her job-related responsibilities absent hardship. So you have to show no, that you did make reasonable accommodation or no reasonable accommodation could be made or that there is hardship, right? You agree with that?
I come close to agreeing with that, Justice Ibsen, but I perhaps want to just qualify it slightly in the sense that reading the two statutes together, the Court of Appeals as well as the Personnel Commission has made it clear that reasonable accommodation under 34.1B is something that has to allow the individual to adequately perform those job functions. Again, there was no reasonable accommodation here. But the second issue goes to hardship. Is there a hardship to the employer? And we think as well there was sufficient evidence of hardship in this case.
But you also concede that you can that it's a reasonable accommodation to change the job in certain respects to accommodate.
I said earlier that if there was a minor function, that may be a reasonable accommodation. I will say that if you look at the precedent that is before this court, including Target as well as Harris, in which the Personnel Committee looked at this issue some time ago.
Harris is in your appendix. It's a workers' comp case, if I remember.
No,
it's a WFEA case.
Yes, Harris is a WFEA case. And there the court looked at it particularly and tried to decide, well, what does the reasonable accommodation mean? And what they said is you can't interpret the reasonable accommodation provision in a way that would permit the complainant to obtain or retain some form of employment with means such as job restructuring or even creation of a new job. Rather, the inquiry about the reasonable accommodation under 1B has to be limited as to whether or not the accommodation would permit the employee to do that job. Interestingly, you know, in Harris, the Personnel Commission looked at it and used it in the term in the context of essential functions, which is sort of adopted from the ADA. But again, in Harris as well, the Commission cited other cases that made it clear that the Commission had not previously ever required an employer to either develop a new position or permanently assign some of the disabled employee's work to other staff. And we think that's exactly what the Commission did here.
And you think that the concept of whether it is a new job or merely a changed job is a question of law that the appellate court or any court, the circuit court, may review on LIRC independently? And what the meaning of reasonable accommodation is.
Yes.
Counsel, following up on that, we have to write a decision. And much of your discussion this morning has been using the phrases to create a new job, to a new position, that position, return to that position. I'd like you to give me your definition of what it means. We define creating a new job as follows, colon.
I think you have to go back to 111.34 sub 2 sub A. And 111.34 sub 2 sub A says...
And I'd like you to finish the sentence.
Sure.
As though you were writing this, colon. How do you finish that sentence?
It says that that an employer is required to reasonably accommodate in situations where the individual is able, with the accommodation, to adequately undertake the job-related responsibilities of that individual's employment. The Court of Appeals found that if an employee could do some of the functions, that was enough. But the wording in the statute doesn't say that. The previous cases don't suggest that. We think the way you've got to write it is to say that if the employee is, even with reasonable accommodation, unable to perform significant functions of that job, the individual is not required a reasonable accommodation.
I'm going to again ask for your indulgence. Would you give me again your definition of creating a new job, finishing that sentence?
Creating a new job is a situation where the employer is required to transfer important job responsibilities or to eliminate job responsibilities for an individual whose medical condition prevents them from performing adequately the existing job.
to transfer important job responsibilities?
Sure.
Is that what you said?
I think that certainly is a fair reading. One could even go further and say the job responsibilities. I think important is fair. It's in the context of the spirit of the statute and also the context of what the federal courts have looked to when they look at essential functions.
Mm-hmm. It just seems so amorphous to me where you draw the line, the important. Well, how important? Really important, sort of important. I mean, if we're looking for a black letter rule of law, it is escaping me because the words are so relative.
I'll confess, Your Honor, that the statute isn't terribly helpful in defining what it meant under 2A when it said the adequately perform the responsibilities of the position. And that's why I suggested to the court that perhaps it would be helpful to look at the ADA cases, because both the statutory framework of the ADA as well as its purpose is analogous to the WFEA.
Except we've been interpreted differently than ADA.
It sort of depends on which case you read. In some cases, the Court of Appeals says we should look to Rehab Act in federal cases. In some cases, they don't. So I guess it depends on what day you're talking to Lurk.
Given the amorphousness of that, as Justice Bradley and your colloquy pointed out, I think that... Isn't that really the reason why we give such great deference to the Labor Industry Review Commission, rather than putting this in the hands of a court to examine all these facts? We give it to a group that handles these cases, handles 50 cases a year or more, and let them determine what's important and what's not.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that, as a general rule, the Labor and Industry Review Commission ought to be afforded deference in cases where it's interpreted a statute consistently over time. In this case, it has not. It hasn't even come close to it. The commission has been all over the board. The cases that we can find most on point use language about the fact that reasonable accommodation does not mean creating new jobs or assigning work that a disabled employee can't do to others. And so I think it really is a question of law for this court to decide whether reasonable accommodation requires that.
Well, and here, again, you've got this added fact that there's four people in this department. Two of them said, hey, we'll lift those 40-pound cheese boxes. She doesn't have to. So, in fact, at least based upon what Lurk seemed to find, that took care of it. The job is 40-pound blocks of cheeses. She couldn't load and unload the hand cart. She couldn't reach boxes at high levels. And two of them said, hey, we'll do that.
Again, that goes to part of the problem we have with what Lurk did here.
What I'm asking is, can that be part of the equation, or does that have to be ignored? The fact that there are other people who are not only willing but are able to perform some of those functions.
Certainly that's a factor that could be considered. I think ultimately that's inconsistent with the statute itself. Mm-hmm. It's also inconsistent with Judge Olstead's finding, which was reversed without ever talking to him. You have to, as it relates to the two people you talked about, the mother and the sister who testified after the wholesale department was closed that they would have been willing to take the responsibility she couldn't do, it's really highly suspect testimony for lots of reasons, including the fact that it's all hypothetical. The warehouse department was already closed. It's also inconsistent with what the sister specifically told Crystal Lake as well as the EEOC concerning whether or not her sister could do that job. And ultimately, it's really the employer's discretion to decide whether or not it makes sense from a production standpoint.
I understand. I'm not questioning the credibility or lack of credibility. I mean, as a general rule of law, as a general matter, when Lurk or courts review this matter, do we take into account that there are substitutes available? Can that be taken into account as part of the, quote, reasonable accommodation?
I think so, Your Honor. If you look at
that we could take that.
You could take it into account, and in fact, the Court of Appeals has in another case where they've looked in situations where an employer has a large general labor pool of 20 or more people, in one case 25 people on a shift, that in that case it might be reasonable to consider assigning some of those responsibilities. I don't think that's consistent with the statute, but you could certainly say that it is. But this case isn't one where we have that. We've got a small labor pool, which everyone agrees everyone had to do. Your Honor,
I'm sorry. For you. It seems to me that when you look at the WFEA cases, that they are consistent in looking for reasonable accommodation and consistent in looking at the job. but they may reach what you call inconsistent decisions based on the specific facts in that particular case. And isn't this whole area just laden with facts and value judgments? And that's why this is the area where you would give great weight and deference to the administrative agency.
Well, again, I would go back to the fact that what constitutes reasonable accommodation is ultimately a question of law, and had LURC or the Court of Appeals been consistent in what it has said about reasonable accommodation, I could probably agree with that statement. But in the context of where we see this case, where the Court of Appeals and others have said other things, I don't think it is reasonable.
Thank you, Mr.
My time is up.
Thank you very much. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Monica Murphy, Wisconsin Coalition for Advocacy.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Monica Murphy. I'm with the Wisconsin Coalition for Advocacy, and I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, Susan Catlin. One of the first things I'd like to talk to the Court about is this idea or this issue of creating a new job. The accommodations that would have worked for Susan Catlin to work in this job were not a new job. She wouldn't have any new duties. She would be doing work that she had always done previously and that she had done well previously. And the only changes that really would have had to take place were some physical modifications of the plant and the elimination of some of the heavier lifting duties from her daily activity.
Counsel, may I ask you please to make sure to speak up?
Sure, I'm sorry.
Let me just ask you about that statement, because I asked opposing counsel, what if you, a new person, but with the same physical disabilities, applied for the job, would Crystal Lake be required to hire that person?
I think that the law does not make any distinctions between new hires and people that have previously worked for an employer.
Well, can you cite there is some?
I don't believe that there is any distinctions, and it just talks about
That's what I'm getting at. Are there distinctions, and if so, what are they? Here, several of the requirements that have been outlined today, the lifting, the reaching, things of that nature, were outlined by opposing counsel as requirements of the job. In fact, I think he said essential requirements of the job. So just taking that into account, what obligation would a company like Crystal Lake have to hire a person with similar difficulties and disabilities?
Well, first off, I would disagree that they were essential functions of Ms. Catlin.
So you disagree that lifting a 40-pound block was not required in this job? Or was
correct. It was something that she did previously. But what's important to understand here is the work situation here. It was a team of four people that did work together as a team. But each of the four people had a specific duty. Ms. Catlin's specific duty was as the lead worker, and the unique duties of the lead worker were processing grocery store orders and doing inventory and some of the paperwork sorts of things.
And lifting at when required, right?
Well, if you'll indulge me a second, she did help others out, and the key here is helping others out.
Well, wasn't that part of her job?
To help others out, certainly.
To do that particular job of lifting. So in other words,
it's not that she's incapable of lifting. At the hearing, she lifted an 18-pound block of cheese.
Yes.
She's incapable of pulling 40-pound blocks of cheese off a high shelf in a cooler. That she's incapable of.
He was incapable. So if a person applied for that job, not Ms. Catlin, but would the company be required to say or required to hire that person?
That they may, if it was a reasonable accommodation, or to modify the job so that it did include that, or they would not have to if they indeed showed that it was a hardship to modify that particular job duty.
Which they didn't do here, at least according to the Court of Appeals.
Correct. The way they worked was, as I said, Ms. Catlin was the lead worker who had her unique duties. There was another position that was the cutter position, and it was primarily that person's duty to take the 40-pound blocks of cheese and cut them into smaller blocks. Once the cheese was cut, they were working primarily with one-pound-sized blocks of cheese.
But I guess the issue is if the cutter wasn't there, I mean, this was a team effort. So part of the team would be doing basically the same things as Ms. Catlin, and Ms. Catlin would be doing the same things as the team.
Correct. Everybody on the team was cross-trained. Mm-hmm. So even if the cutter wasn't there, there was at least two other people, the cryovacker and the labeler, who also knew how to operate the cutter and could do that piece of the cutter's job.
Ms. Murphy, doesn't this case really turn on this? The employer decides what the jobs are. So the employer decides what the elements of the job, what the job responsibilities are. And that if an employee, either to be hired or one that is already there, cannot do those jobs, then there is no, that under 2A, I think I've got it right, that under 2A, they're not, the person can't do the job, is not qualified, and therefore there's no need to hire them, or they can be fired, because the disability is reasonably related to the individual's ability to adequately undertake the job-related responsibilities of that individual's employment.
I think that needs to be read in conjunction with the requirement of reasonable accommodation. So if the individual could be reasonably accommodated to perform the job functions, then I think the employer is obligated.
And you're saying reasonably accommodate means changing the job somewhat.
I think that a restructuring of job duties has indeed been found to be a reasonable accommodation in many cases, and it's, you know, opposing counsel is urging us to follow the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Americans with Disabilities Act says within its definition of a reasonable accommodation, the very first definition is restructuring job duties.
Okay, so your position is there can be a restructuring. Now, who determines whether there should be restructuring? I mean, Wisconsin Cheese says, look, I put up the money for this business, I have to make the profit. I decide whether it can be restructured. And if I say it's essential, who are you? Who is the administrative agency? Who's the court to say no?
I think it's really a matter of fact. Look at what's going on in that job. How has the job historically been done? Is this really a big part of how this job is done? How has it been done in the past? I mean, the interesting thing here is that historically, they all did separate duties, and it was actually Ms. Catlin's idea when she took over as lead worker in the department to have people cross-train so that they could indeed help each other out. So I think it's a very fact-specific determination, and it's got to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
So it's a matter of restructuring versus a new job? Is that where...
I would certainly argue that. I don't see what would have been required to accommodate Ms. Catlin's job was not to create a new job. It was to restructure some of the functions so that the heaviest lifting duties were not her obligation.
But is there any point at which a restructuring of a job or elimination of job responsibilities becomes the creation of a new job?
I'm certain that there is, and I am certain that there are times when an employer would not have to do that if it ceased to be reasonable or if it imposed a hardship on the employer. But here the employer did not.
Well, here, for instance, what if it was the cutter that was injured rather than Ms. Catlin? Wouldn't it, it strikes me that since the cutter's primary responsibility was to lift these heavy things and get them down there, that would require creating a new job to give that cutter a different job.
And in that particular position, that may well have been true. It may have been a hardship to relieve the cutter of something that was the primary function of the cutter. But cutting was not the primary function of Susan Catlin, and dipping the wrapped cheese in the hot water bath was not the primary function of Ms. Catlin. Those were the things that she was no longer able to do, but they were not her primary function as the lead worker in the department.
Was she required to do those operations on a daily basis? Isn't that supported by the record?
I think there's some evidence that she would lift 40-pound blocks of cheese on a daily basis.
And that she would be called upon to fill in for the other members of the department on a daily
basis. Correct. But she certainly could do many of the duties of the other people in the department even after her accident. She could still do all the labeling function. She could still wrap the cheese. She could weigh the cheese. She could put it through the Crayovac machine, which is like a plastic, puts the cheese in the plastic wrappers and seals them. The only function of the Crayovac job that she was no longer able to do is once the cheese is wrapped and put in these packages, to dip it in the hot water bath to shrink wrap it.
I don't want to get too bogged down on the facts of this particular case because I think what we have here is an important legal issue about the parameters of the defense that is available under sub 2A of 111.34 in relationship to the requirements of sub 1B to reasonably accommodate unless there's a hardship. That's the legal issue that's present in this case, and as I see it, the agency's interpretation of those statutory subsections is in a state of flux and could be construed to have eliminated or vastly circumscribed that defense that's available in sub 2A. So if you would, with me, look at the language in sub 2A and let me know how you would have us interpret it. It says that there is a defense. It's not job discrimination to if the employer engages in one of the activities, the prohibited activities, refusal to hire, employ, admit, or license, or terminate from employment, if the disability is reasonably related to the individual's ability to adequately undertake the job-related responsibilities of the employment. So where, how do we interpret adequately undertake the job-related responsibilities of the employment? The company says it's not necessarily all, but it's more than some. Because the agency's interpretation here said if the employee can perform some of the job responsibilities, that's enough. I mean, you're arguing in favor of the agency's interpretation, so I assume that for your purposes, some is enough.
And actually, I would argue in this case it was most. She really could do most of the functions of the job. I think that the two provisions have to be read together, and I think that that's what some of the courts have done. That was specifically what was done in the Target Stores case, is that you can't Mr. Rice will talk a little bit about the history of the statute and how these two provisions came in at different times. But I think that they have to be read together, and you have to look at can they perform the functions with or without reasonable accommodations.
We have to come up with a legal rule for purposes of interpreting this defense. And your position is that some is not sufficient, that most is
I think whenever you get into these most and sums, it's
that's the whole problem with the
very,
case.
We need
a legal rule.
Well, and that's the problem with disability, basically. I mean, no two disabilities are the same. Even people with the same diagnosis have very different limitations and different, very different abilities. No two jobs are the same. No two accommodations are the same for any particular job. They're done in different environments. Hardship may be different depending on the size of the employer or the finances of the employer or some other conditions of the employer. So it really is not lend itself well to a black letter rule.
But you would concede that some is too low, that an employee who is only able, with reasonable accommodation, to perform some of the job responsibilities, that doesn't fall within the defense, or at least under those circumstances, the employer would have a defense.
I don't think some helps us one way or the other.
What about more than 50% and less than 50% of the job?
I think it's really got to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
Counsel, in this case, paragraph 14 of the findings of LIRT use the terms that we are just discussing. Paragraph 14 says, as of the date she sought reinstatement, the complainant was physically able to perform most of the jobs in the wholesale department, including training of people, making boxes, making labels, baking, labeling cheese, etc. Then you get to paragraph 15, and it says the complainant could not perform some of the heaviest physical tasks. What effect, if any, do you know, since we're trying to grapple with some and most, here they found she could do most and she couldn't do some. Is that of any import to our analysis?
I don't think it's the clearest guidance that could possibly be offered, but certainly most implies more than 50%, and some implies less than 50%. There were less than 50% of the jobs that she could no longer do.
Well, the other thing they say is primary and secondary. This, the ones that she couldn't perform, they say, are not primary to her, and that she was replaceable by two or three other employees as to those jobs. So it's not only most or some, but are they easily transferable? Are they primarily or secondarily?
And I think that's going to be part of the case-by-case analysis, because one of the things you look at, are there other people to do these jobs? Is this position exists solely for this particular function, or is this sort of a de minimis part of this job, or is this sort of a side task that this job has? I think those are all factors that go into determining how critical the particular task is to the job.
I ask, from the testimony that I read, and I didn't read it all, the first hour or hour and a half of the day was taken to process orders from grocery stores and that sort of thing. How much of the rest of the day was involved in paperwork tasks?
I don't recall the specific testimony on that. There certainly was some, but Ms. Catlin did other things as well during the course of the day, many of which she could still do. You know, she then would, when she was done with her paperwork and her grocery store, processing her grocery store orders, then she did help out the other individuals doing such things as labeling and weighing cheese and putting it in the wrappers.
In paragraph 14, talks about as of the date she sought reinstatement. What is that date? Is that the date of the hearing, or is that in the fall of 1997?
My time is up. Would you like me to continue? Yes. That was in the fall of 1997. That's when she attempted to go back to work. Her phone calls were not returned. Nobody talked to her. The employer made some inquiries apart from Ms. Catlin,
What is the evidence that in the fall of 1997 she could have done any of these things?
The evidence is her own testimony. Part of the problem here is the employer never explored what she could or could not do in the fall of 1997. They made assumptions. They assumed she couldn't do anything. They assumed she could do no physical work. Mr. Robertson's testimony said, oh, we couldn't have somebody who could only do paper. We couldn't have somebody who could do no physical work. But when he was pressed about what physical work included, it included many tasks that Ms. Catlin could do. So there wouldn't need, she could do those things. You didn't need to hire somebody else to do them for her.
So the commission's findings of fact in paragraph 14 are based on the testimony of Susan Catlin?
Yes, and I believe as well the report of Mr. Annis, who had worked with Ms. Catlin and then reviewed the job sites.
Thank you, Counsel. Assistant Attorney General David Rice, representing LIRC.
May it please the Court, my name is David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I appear on behalf of the Labor and Industry Review Commission. I probably could do an hour's worth of argument this morning and try to do the best I can in 15 minutes to address the questions raised by the Court today. We're here to consider specific provisions of the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. That act was first passed in 1945, but it wasn't until 1965 that the term handicap was added. That was added by Chapter 230 of the laws of 1965. And it also provided the language about the person, the employer having the discretion to terminate an employee who could not adequately perform the job duties. It was slightly different verbiage than we have now. The current verbiage came in 1975 in Chapter 275, Laws of 75. There was no definition of handicap in the law at that point. There was no requirement of reasonable accommodation at that point. The reasonable accommodation language was not added until 1981 by Chapter 334 of the Laws of 1981. It provides us with no definition of reasonable accommodation. It provides us with no clear direction as to how the addition of the reasonable accommodation requirement is to be interpreted with the earlier language. In other words, the two sections that you have to address in reaching your decision today. I would like to though, point out historically that the law, because it provided no definition of handicap, it forced this court to adopt a definition of handicap. In the Chicago Railroad case, this court went to the dictionary and said that handicap means an impairment which makes achievement unusually difficult or limits the capacity to work. Well, that sufficed for a long time, and then in the LaCrosse case, cited in our brief, the court further explained what that meant. And what the court said, well, impairment that makes achievement unusually difficult will equate to the Americans with Disability Act definition of substantially limiting a major life activity. But limiting the capacity to work must mean something else. So we'll interpret that to mean not being able to do the particular job under consideration. That by far is a much more liberal interpretation than the Americans with Disabilities Act would allow. Under that statute, you have to be excluded from a large geographic area and a broad range of jobs to be considered disabled. So I point that out merely to show that there are differences in language between the ADA and the WFEA. We have that same difference in language at the issue that's before you today. The Americans with Disabilities Act simply excludes from coverage a person who cannot perform, quote, the essential functions of the job, unquote, with or without reasonable accommodation. If the employer can make that threshold showing that the person cannot perform those essential functions, and Justice Abramson, you asked what those were, the statute gives the employer great deference in the ADA in determining what are essential functions. If the person cannot do those functions, then the question of whether a particular accommodation might be reasonable or whether it might create a hardship is never reached. Now, I didn't hear that argument so much today in the oral argument that was presented by the employer. But in their briefs and in the amicus brief filed by the Manufacturers Association and the Cheesemakers, I understood them to be urging this court to construe those two provisions of the Fair Employment Act at issue here to achieve a result consistent with the ADA, so that we wouldn't be dealing with these questions that have been raised by the court today about what's reasonable and what isn't, or what's a hardship or what isn't, because you wouldn't have to address those questions under the approach that they are advocating. They want you to interpret the Act like the ADA. The Commission urges the opposite.
Well, what, refresh for me, it's been a few days, how would the ADA handle it? Give it to the employers?
The ADA would say if you can't perform all the, quote, essential functions of the job, unquote, if the employer tells you what the essential functions are, that's the end of the case. You wouldn't take evidence on what's reasonable in terms of an accommodation. You wouldn't take evidence on whether a particular accommodation forces a hardship or not. That's the main point that I want to make to you today, that the Fair Employment Act should at least allow these disabled individuals an opportunity to come into the door. In 1981, when the statute was amended, the legislature changed the declaration of policy, and in 111.31 sub 2 said, the legislature intends in promulgating this Act to encourage employers to evaluate an employee or applicant for employment based on the employee or applicant's individual qualifications rather than upon a particular class to which the individual may belong. Now, if my premise is correct that disabled persons at least ought to get a hearing, then we'd reach the questions that I think are also before the court and that Justice Sykes was asking about, is how do you interpret the phrase reasonable accommodation in light of the pre-existing language about allowing an employer to terminate an employee who no longer can perform adequately. And the language, I noticed in the paper today they're going to have a writing requirement to get into the UW. Maybe they should have a writing requirement for legislative draftspersons as well, because this language is very difficult. There's a lot of qualifiers, reasonably related, adequately performed. It's pretty much a nightmare in terms of drafting. But we don't have any guidance. And when the first reported case to consider these issues, McMullen, came before District 3 of the Court of Appeals, they were faced with a situation where an employee could no longer perform his job duties. Now, under the statute, and I think that's the reading that the employer's urging here, if you cannot perform the duties of your job, and we'll get to the summer most or all in a minute, then you're entitled to terminate the employee. And that's it. And reasonable accommodation would only enter in to assisting the person to do that particular job, and if you can't do it anymore, you're out. So what did they do in McMullen? The choice was to come out that way. That was one argument presented. And the other argument was you have to consider the person for a transfer to a job that's vacant that they can do. Now, under the employer's reading in this case, the employer wouldn't have that obligation. The employer would be free to terminate the employee who no longer could perform the job adequately. So you have to read those two provisions together, and that's what the court did in McMullen.
What was the commission's position in the McMullen case?
You know, that I was afraid you might ask that question. The commission's position was that the employer had the duty to accommodate. And then when we got to court, and I was arguing it on behalf of the commission, and after some discussion, I argued the opposite view. And that's why the commission, if you look at McMullen, there was no deference accorded to the commission in that case, because they argued a position in court that was different than the position that they decided in the case. But since that time, and remember, the Act was amended in 81 to deal with reasonable accommodation. Since that time, the commission has had over 20 years of experience in deciding these kinds of cases. And contrary to counsel's position, I believe the commission has been consistent. And if you look at the decision cited in my brief on the standard of review, I would suggest to you that the commission is entitled to great weight deference in this case in its interpretation of the statute.
What's
and secondarily,
the commission's interpretation?
The commission's interpretation, I was going to add one more point because it's been asked before, is what about the application of the reasonable accommodation provision? Is that a question of law or is it a question of fact? Well, literally, you've said that applying a statutory definition to a particular set of facts can be a question of law. But if you look at McMullen, I think that the answer to that question is the commission determines in the first place whether an accommodation is reasonable, and the courts on review determine whether, I guess as a matter of law, it's so unreasonable that they couldn't have reached that result. It's essentially the same standard as the substantial evidence standard.
As the what standard?
The substantial evidence standard. But let's get to the crux of the case then. How do you interpret these two provisions together? And I would suggest to you that the way to interpret them together is essentially to have a continuum. If you buy my premise that the employee gets into the hearing room in the first place, then the whole question turns on, can the employee do the job with reasonable accommodation? Now, what's going to be reasonable in any particular case is going to depend on the nature of the job and is going to depend on the type of accommodations that have to be made in the particular case. Probably, I would say in most cases where I'm doing the same thing. In most cases, however, where the employee can only perform some of the jobs, there's not going to be a reasonable accommodation available. And the employee is going to lose because there isn't going to be a reasonable accommodation available. Perhaps ironically, I would commend to you the ADA definitions of the terms reasonable accommodation and hardship. Reasonable accommodation in the ADA includes job restructuring. Now, there, of course, it's only used to modify the non-essential functions of the job. But clearly, it's the kind of accommodation that could be reached. So I would suggest to you that you'd read those two provisions together, you read them in harmony, and that you leave to the commission to determine in any particular factual case, to resolve the same kinds of questions that we've been talking about this morning that you've raised. Could she do this function? Couldn't she do that function? What effect would it have on the employer? When you look at hardship in the federal definition, and I'm looking at 42 U.S. Code Section 12.111, definition of reasonable accommodation is sub 9, the definition of undue hardship is sub 10. And when you look at hardship, you look at the nature of the accommodation, the cost of the accommodation, you look at the cost in terms of its relationship to the overall financial resources of the employer. What's hardship for one may not be hardship for another.
Now, just want to ask if this interrupting your thought process, but it seems to me that the opposing counsel would say, in this case, as far as hardship, undue hardship, but it's hardship under the WFEA, is something that really wasn't looked at, such as the nature and cost. Well, they tossed out the 47,000 figure because of the hearsay rule, that the characteristics of the facility, the financial resources, number of employees, the effect of the accommodation on the employee, on the facility's operations, the financial resources, size, things of that nature.
Well, I think that's an important point.
But that wasn't answered here.
Yes, well, I think it was answered, Justice Wilcox, and that's what I want to ask you, I want to tell you. The trial counsel in this case was someone other than these two gentlemen who are at counsel table. And I would suggest to you that he dropped the ball here, much as he dropped the cheese during the hearing. What he didn't, I think they thought they were going to win on the ADA version of the statute. I think they didn't believe they had to put much evidence in on reasonable accommodation or hardship because they thought they were going to win on the question of not giving the employee the opportunity to even come to the hearing. They didn't put in proof. On the question of the $47,000 estimate, which was hearsay evidence, if you look at it, I put this in my appendix because I think this is an important point of administrative law, which I hope the court looks at. The Court of Appeals, initially, in their first decision, said the agency cannot base its findings on hearsay. So even if it wasn't objected to when it came in, long-standing principle that agencies can't base their findings on uncorroborated hearsay. For some reason, they withdrew that on an errata sheet, and they said, and it's in my appendix, the evidence here doesn't show the kinds of things we were just talking about. It doesn't show the relationship between the cost to the employer's overall cost of doing business. There's been some argument today about how it would disrupt the process to have others have to do her task and how it would slow things down. That wasn't explored at the record, again, because the employer didn't litigate it. Now, should the employer have a chance to have a remand? I guess, Justice Crooks, I think you asked that question. I'd say the answer is no. I think the Court of Appeals is exactly right. In the last sentence or two of their decision, they say you can't decide to change your strategy and get another opportunity to relitigate the case. You make a strategy choice. It worked here in getting the case to this court because it allowed this important question to be front and center. But they didn't litigate it. They had an opportunity to litigate it. They could have made a complete record, and they didn't. Now, I also cite Judge Eaton's decision, the circuit court judge. And what he says, if you adopt the premise that I'm urging you to adopt and leave the determination of what's reasonable in terms of those two statutes and applying them harmoniously, that can be done on a case-by-case basis without breaking the what he called the fiscal vertebrae of Wisconsin employers. Because not only do you have the commission there to make decisions, but you have the reviewing courts acting as a brake on anything that the commission would decide was unreasonable.
Except if it's a factual determination, the standard of review.
The standard
is
of review
high
is
that it's outcome determinative.
Well, there certainly have been cases in this court, and I certainly have had cases in the last 30 years where courts have said that the agency could not reasonably have reached the result that it did, as a matter of fact. I understand it's a high standard, and we do that purposely. But it can be done.
So what exactly is the agency's interpretation of the language in sub 2A other than it doesn't operate as a complete bar as the federal act does?
Right. 2A means that the employee has to be able to do the job.
What's the job?
With
who defines
accommodation.
What the job is?
If it's reasonable. What aspects of the job that have to be done are those that are reasonable, and that's the break. The reasonable accommodation provision construed harmoniously with the first provision means you have to do that much of the job as would be a reasonable amount of the work in order to the employer to operate without hardship.
Rice, on finding of fact number 14, what is the evidence that Ms. Catlin could make boxes, make labels, bake cheese, label cheese, weigh cheese?
Your Honor, I have my red light is on. May I answer Justice Prosser's question?
Yes, certainly, Mr. Rice.
Justice Prosser, I have nothing to add to what trial counsel told you, that it was the testimony of Ms. Catlin as to what she was able to do.
Well, why is it different that her testimony of what she could have done almost more than 2 years before is credited, but the testimony about the $47,000 is not credited?
Well,
I mean, could she not, now this is unfair, but could she not have actually done all of those things, demonstrated them?
I'll answer both of those points. The distinction between the two is that the testimony about the $47,000 was hearsay. Her testimony about what she could or couldn't do was not hearsay, so you don't have the hearsay problem. But secondarily, you know, the ideal world, you probably would have had some communication between the employer and the employee. They might have brought the employee to the job and say, okay, let's see if you can do these functions anymore. We have two experts who have some disagreement about that. We'll put you here for a day, and we'll see how you perform. That would have been the kind of interactive process that the statute envisions and would have allowed for an accommodation if it were reasonable.
Mr. Mr. Duffy made a point that I think needs response. I think it's a good, he made a good point, at least one that troubles me, and that is that the FERC overruled their own hearing examiner without consulting him or anything of that sort. How do you respond to that?
Well, the requirement of consultation is triggered by situations in which there's a difference in findings based on credibility. And the theory is that the commission should have the benefit of the examiner's impression of the demeanor of the witnesses. That's really all that's required other than an explanation of why they reached a different result. I don't put much weight in that. Anyway, I mean, it's a longstanding rule, and I'm not going to persuade you to change that rule here because I'm not sure demeanor evidence really is that important. But in this particular case, the commission decided that that they were not differing so much with the examiner on credibility as they were differing as to the legal consequence of whether the person could do the job. I think the employer, the examiner, if you read his decision in its entirety, essentially adopted the employer's rationale, that if you couldn't perform enough of the duties, then the employee loses. And I think the commission viewed the evidence in a different light because of the different rationale that it adopted in the decision. If I'm wrong about that, the remedy is to remand the case to the commission to consult with the examiner and then to issue a new decision after consultation with the examiner. But I don't think that's why, I mean, you may decide that is necessary for purposes of disposition of the case, but that's not why the case is here before the court.
I want you to again tell me how one of us, if we rule in your favor, should write this decision to harmonize these statutes. As I understood you, you think 2A means that the employee will be able to do the job with reasonable accommodation and without hardship to the employer. So that, now you said you were going to talk about some and most and essential, but you haven't.
No,
First of all, did I state you properly?
Yes.
Okay. So, well, we're back to the job. Does it mean all of the job, all elements of the job?
I don't see any way to write this decision in a way. The statute certainly provides us no guidance, but I don't think you can have benchmarks of some, most, or all, 50% or more, 50% or less. The way I read those statutes, job modification is a required form of accommodation. A job modification may mean that you're not able to perform all of the duties. How many of the duties you have to perform depends on what's reasonable, because the statute imposes a duty of reasonable accommodation. So it's essentially a sliding scale when you read those two statutes together.
And not undue hardship. So in a particular instance, failing to be able to do one part of the job may be such undue hardship on the employer that that's it.
Right.
But that,
Is that right?
I believe that's correct.
But that interpretation means that whenever, in the view of the agency, it's reasonable to create a new job, the employer has to create a new job. Because I haven't heard you address the sort of threshold question that I asked your co-counsel, which is, at what point does the modification of job responsibilities or transfer of job responsibilities become the creation of a new job for purposes of the defense in sub 2A? And that hasn't been addressed other than the amorphous reasonableness standard,
well,
which
is sort of
in the eye of the beholder.
The statute doesn't tell us what the job is. The Court of Appeals suggested that the job can continue to be, as counsel suggested, the job with modifications. And when does that become not the job? Then that would be a point at which either the statute wouldn't apply, or reading them together, it would be unreasonable. I can't come up with a language for you to help Justice Bradley to draft the opinion that says it's going to be this benchmark, or it's this quantum of the job responsibilities to satisfy the first provision. That's why I think you have to read them harmoniously. You have to say that it's a sliding standard, and it's not reasonable if it creates a new job, or it's not reasonable if it requires, it creates an undue hardship.
And you think that the commission has been consistent in using this kind of sliding scale standard?
Yes, I think that. I mean, there's cases that predate the addition of the word reasonable accommodation, because the commission interpreted the statute to require reasonable accommodation. And the case that strikes me as maybe the most similar was a guy who was teaching outdoor living and driver's education, did archery, and became blind and couldn't do significant parts of the job anymore, but could do them with an aid. And there was a dispute about whether that would create a hardship, but that case goes to my brief, Fisher versus Alma School District, way back in the late 70s. And I think if you look at the decisions, as you point out, on any particular case with any particular commission, and they change regularly, you may get a different result on the facts. But I think the principle has been applied reasonably consistently.
That's what
the principle is.
The principle that you have to modify job duties as part of reasonable accommodation. If I understand the employer, they're saying, no, you don't have to modify job duties unless it's something so non-essential that it satisfies the federal definition. It's not an easy case, but it's an important one. I've appeared before you several times this term on whether a particular dispute goes to a particular forum. I think this is more important because it has to do with whether the disabled population, which the statute was designed to protect, get even into the hearing room in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Duffy?
Yes. I am mystified as to the statement that the commission has been consistent on this. We cited Harris, the Personnel Commission's decisions in 1987 that looked at this issue. Harris specifically said that reasonable accommodation under 1B and 2A does not mean job restructuring or even creation of a new job. Harris even cited previous commission decisions, McFadden, which we cited, which specifically said that it's not reasonable accommodation to permanently assign some of the disabled employees' work to other staff. That's the Rao decision, the 1987 Personnel Commission decision. And we also cited McFadden for the fact that the commission found that reasonable accommodation does not mean you have to develop a new position for an employee.
Does reasonable accommodation mean you have to modify a job?
Well, the commission has said no in various decisions. I don't think that's necessarily reasonable. I think in situations where you're not dealing with essential or important functions, it may be reasonable to allow an individual or someone else to do those functions, but that's not the case here. These were important daily functions that Ms. Caitlin needed to do as a lead person in that warehouse department, and she couldn't do them. And there was no reasonable accommodation that would allow her to do that.
Well, then your position, Mr. Rice thinks your position is that there need be no modification of the job duties. That is not your position. Is that right? Your position is that there may have to be modification of job duties.
We've articulated throughout that we think important standards would be under the ADA. Because
pardon me?
Under the ADA. Look to the ADA for guidance.
He says the ADA, and I don't pretend to be an expert on the federal ADA, says if you're going to change the essential duties, you never get to look at reasonable accommodation. He says that's not what our statute says.
I think that's exactly what our statute says. I mean, first of all, the ADA says that an employer does have an obligation to reasonably accommodate one so that they can perform the essential functions. We believe that's true under the WFEA as well, that if there is an accommodation that will allow a person to perform the essential functions, then the employer should do it unless it can prove hardship. We think we have hardship here, but apart from that, there was no accommodation that would allow her to do the job. There was an expensive accommodation that would allow her to get to the plant, and we think that was unreasonable as a matter of law. But we think that you, as far as the guidance that the court needs, I think it's fair to look to the ADA and the cases under the ADA. The commission certainly has in the past. The Court of Appeals has. And it's pretty clear under those cases that if you look within the context of important or essential functions, that ought to be the guidepost for employers. Employers in Wisconsin understand that. It's a well-developed area of law. It's certainly consistent with 2A's provision about the fact that the employee has to be able to adequately perform the job responsibilities.
It seems that you both disagree not only about the Wisconsin statute, about the federal statute, too. Is that right?
I'm surprised at that, but it sounds like we do in some respects. I think that, Justice Sykes, you've asked, and I think others have as well implicitly, who ultimately has to decide this as far as who decides what jobs are available. Ultimately, it's got to be an employer, because if it's not the employer that decides what the important functions are, who is it? The commission or the ALJ? Individuals or bodies that don't have any duty to make a profit, who don't have any idea about whether those services are really needed, who don't know whether or not, in fact, they have a customer that will pay for a job that doesn't exist or is so modified it's going to be a problem. It's got to be the employer that decides those things.
And what good is the statute?
Well, the statute's good because it basically says that an employer has a duty to reasonably accommodate, which we think should be interpreted to mean provide accommodations that would allow that employee to do the essential functions, the important functions of that job.
Are you saying that the employer should unilaterally be able to determine what is reasonable with no right of appeal?
Well, no, I'm not saying that, Your Honor, but I'm saying it's the employer in the first instance that has to decide what the job entails. It's the employer that pays the employee that has to decide whether there's a job out there that it can make money on to employ someone. And I think 2A...
Okay, so he does, and there's no right of appeal?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I think there's certainly a right of appeal as to whether or not some accommodation would be reasonable that would allow an employee to perform the important functions of a job. Certainly there's a right of appeal on that. Again, on this record, I don't think there's any doubt, any dispute, that there was no reasonable accommodation that would allow Ms. Catlin to perform the important functions of her job. Perhaps a last point that I could make. I appreciated Mr. Rice's thought that we dropped the cheese or dropped the ball here on this case. I think that this has been a very difficult decision. I think that that's part of the problem is what happened with Labor Needs Review Commission and not going back to the ALJ. Even on that very subject of whether or not Ms. Catlin was able to lift the cheese, only the judge could observe what happened. There's no record that could do that. Thank you very much.
But Mr. Duffy, do you agree that the ADA looks at ability to do any job versus the ability to do that particular job? I mean, if I understood Mr. Rice correctly.
Yeah, certainly, Your Honor, if you look at the ADA and what it has found to be reasonable accommodation, it includes the obligation to transfer an employee to an available position, the essential functions of which the disabled employee could perform. And McMullen tells us the same thing. I think that's certainly a fair standard. Again, that's not the case here, but it's certainly fair.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy and Ms. Murphy and Mr. Rice for a very able argument in this case that presents many difficult issues. Thank you. And that concludes our hearing on 02-0815, Crystal Lake Cheese Factory versus Lurk and Susan Cat. Court will take a few moments recess so that the courtroom may be cleared of those who wish to leave.